Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and really pleased to welcome back Diana Alfeth with us from our studios in Eau Claire. Diana is a UW Extension horticulture educator from Pierce County. I'm going to be talking with her to tell you about whether or not your shrub will come back due to winter injury, and maybe what to replace it with, or maybe how to save it. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. And of course, we'll be answering all of your other gardening questions too as we go along. So look forward to hearing from you either by phone or at ideas@wpr.org. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here.
So what kind of winter damage have you been seeing? We've been getting a lot of reports on Garden Talk about it.
Yeah, and I think it's statewide, and up here in the northern half of the state, we're especially seeing it on burning bushes. They seem to have died back to the ground. There's little shoots coming up at the bottom. Snow mound spirea, the bridal wreath type spirea, lots of problems with that. And I'm even seeing it on grapes are starting to show it because they're leafing out and now wilting off. And I'm even seeing it on some fruit trees, like some younger crab apples and apple trees and things like that. So it's pretty widespread.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So what do is there some point in the season when you can tell if your shrub's coming back or your tree?
Yeah, well, so what happens is most of the leaf buds that would be leafing out at this time of year were formed on these plants last year, and so then they were damaged over the winter. In a lot of cases, what was damaged was the vascular system, so the connection between the roots and the top of the tree, so in the branches and in the trunks. And there's enough energy in the leaves that they've leafed out, and this is especially true on the maples and the grapes and things like that. They leafed out, and everything looked fine and dandy, and now all of a sudden they're wilting. And so I'm getting quite a few calls about that. And when you get those symptoms, it's because of some kind of a break between the connection from the roots to the top of the tree. And there are several things that could do that. One, the most obvious one that we would be looking at is if the mice or voles or the rabbits girdled and chewed on the bark and basically physically broke that connection from the roots to the top of the tree. And now those leaves need water and the roots can't get it there, and that's why they're wilting down. So that's one of the most common things that we're seeing right now. And if there's no damage that way, we look for any other kind of old wound on the trunk or anything like that that might be causing those symptoms. But if we don't see any of that sort of a thing, then the concern is that the actual cold damaged those cells under the trunk or under the bark along the trunk and broke that connection from the roots to the top of the tree.
That's not very good news.
No, it's not, because unfortunately there's nothing we can do about it. That once that connection is broken, it's broken, and that plant or that tree is really not going to make it. Now, what might happen, especially like on a maple tree or a crabapple tree, is that in a little while you'll get shoots from below the damage. So if there's an actual wound on the trunk, you might get a shoot below that. And then you have to ask yourself, well, okay, I've got a root system. Where's this shoot coming from? If it's a tree that was a specific variety of fruit or crabapple or maple, and that there's going to be a graft, and that's a little jog that should be on the trunk about, 6-8 inches from the ground. If that shoot is coming out from above that graft, then it will be the same as the actual tree that you planted. If it's coming out from below that graft, then it's coming from the rootstock, and that is not going to be the tree that you planted. So you can take a risk and let it grow. In any event, if it's sending up multiple shoots, you should just choose one to let it grow up and try to become the new trunk. And you might get a tree back, but it kind of depends on how big your tree was, how old your tree is, where it is, and if you're patient and all that stuff. And in most cases, it's probably better to just remove the tree and plant something new and, hope that we don't get another polar vortex anytime soon.
Yeah. And And for replacing, are there some varieties that are more likely to survive harsh winters?
You know, most of what we plant is hardy. You know, we always
Right.
We always tell people, make sure that you plant something hardy to the area, whether you're in the northern part of the state or the southern part of the state in zone five. Or, and once you do that, it should be okay. Now, we don't get these polar vortexes. Well, I don't know. We seem to be getting them more often.
Yeah.
But when the tree is older and it has a corkier, thicker bark on it, it's less likely to get damaged because there's more insulation there. One of the things we always tell people, of course, is to wrap young trees so that that thin bark, which isn't thick enough to protect against the winter conditions, we usually are more worried about sun scalds, so the sun warming the trunk and those cells becoming active underneath the bark, and then they freeze and they snap, and that's when we get the wounds on the side of the on the trunk, usually on the south or southwest side of the trunk. So we do that, but once we pick a tree that's hardy to your zone, it should be okay. It's just that nature throws these extremes at us every now and then. And honestly, when it's 32 below for a week straight, or whatever we had, I don't know, maybe
I
it wasn't that bad. It seems it seems like it was that bad. Right. A lot of things that come into play on whether a plant is going to be damaged. It's not just how cold it gets, but it's at what time of the year. It's at what stage the tree is or the plant is in dormancy. And it's also the duration of that
how
cold.
Long? Yeah.
Right. And this year we had that cold spell for such a long period of time. And I think that's part of it. In some cases, the winter damage is actually root damage. There were some reports up around here that the soil had gotten down to 13 degrees, which is crazy cold. Usually the average soil temperature is going to be in the maybe 24, 23, something like that. And so in some cases, the winter dieback that we're seeing isn't even the trunk. It's actually the roots. But oddly enough, there's less of that in the southern part because there was some snow cover down there. There was more. There was earlier snow cover insulating the soil in the southern part of the state than in the northern part up here anyway this year. So, so that didn't protect the roots as much up here. So there's a variety of things that have caused the winter injury. Boxwoods, we don't grow a lot of them in the north because they're marginally hardy, but those that are here, and I know the in the southern part where there's a lot of boxwoods, they've really taken a hit. Lots and lots of brown boxwoods, and that's winter injury as well. And so then your question is what to do about it, right? And with the trees, there's really not much you can do other than see if you get a new shoot. But with the shrubs, like the burning bush and the snow mound spirea, that the top is dead, it's not leafing out, but there's leafy shoots coming from the base, what you can try to do is to prune away anything that's dead. And I always encourage people to give it plenty of time to make sure that anything that's going to leaf out has leafed out. And we're kind of at that spell now. We're farther along in the season that if it hasn't leafed out by now, it's probably not going to. But you can go ahead and prune back anything that's dead. And that's the general rule all the time. You can prune away anything that's dead, dying, or diseased. And prune it all the way back down to where there's live tissue. And the good news is you have an established root system already, so those shoots have will really grow up fast, but you're going to have a much shorter shrub for a couple of years. But it, but at least it may be savable.
Sure, for sure. Well, we have all our lines filled and some emails as well. So let's go to Marty first in Douglas County. Marty, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much. I'm so happy you're having this program today. We have a spectacular tiger's eye sumac. It's about 4.5 feet tall and 4 feet wide. It's just been gangbusters growing the last couple of years. It's only about a tenth leafed out right now. It's got lots of little, I don't know, nodules, whatever the little guys are on the side of the stem from which the leaves come. But my questions are, how patient should we be? And in worst case scenario, is this also something we could be trimming back.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're in Douglas County, so that's north-north, and things are obviously slower. I would be a little more patient. If there's – one of the things that you can do is just take your thumbnail and scrape on the twigs or on those buds, and if it's green underneath, then there's still hope because that means that there's live tissue in there yet. So I would be probably a couple of more weeks yet before I would decide what's alive and what's not. And sometimes it's a little more challenging because you might have a branch and there's a few leaves at the tip, but some of the leaf buds have died and so it's just very sparse. In that case, I'd kind of just let it go because you don't want to prune away live tissue if you don't have to.
Right.
And it might be a little thin and scraggly looking this year, but usually over time then, as those buds and the new growth comes on, it fills out and kind of gets a little thicker
you may be happier next year, Marty.
Right. And the other thing is that you can – after you've given it enough time and you kind of see what it looks, well, then you can do some shaping pruning or some rejuvenation pruning that you would – just like you would do normally. But it just might take a couple of years to get it looking that gangbusters again like you had. It's just going to have to recover. But you can – like I say, you can scrape your nail on it and see if there's green under it. Then you know it's alive. But being in Douglas County and the – you know, this – has been I call it a reluctant spring because
yes.
it's just been, you know, stop and go all the way here. I'd give it a couple more weeks before you make any real decisions on trimming anything.
There you go, Marty. Thank you so much for calling. Martin in Madison up next. Hi, Martin.
Hi. I have a question about Japanese beetles. I have a garden that I'm sharing, a community garden that I'm sharing with some others. I have some plants in the ground, and I have some in a raised bed. And my question is, when you can't hardly turn over a spade of dirt without seeing a grub in the ground. And my question would be, two, when will those grubs begin to emerge and start eating our garden? And what can I use to treat the plants that I have in the ground?
Okay. So where did you say you are?
Madison.
Madison. Okay.
Madison.
Okay. So the adults usually emerge around the 1st of July up here. So it's probably going to be like the last week of June or so down in Madison area.
Yeah.
Does that sound right, Larry?
No, that's about right.
Okay. So that's – right now those grubs should be going into pupil stage. So they'll not be grubs. They'll be – transforming into the adult beetles here within the next couple of weeks. So, and because we did get a late spring, you know, things might be a little bit later than normal. So, obviously, you squish every grub you find when you dig them, when you're digging in the garden right now. But chances are there's going to be a lot of adults around. So, as far as protecting the plants that you have planted, there's, you know, the pick them off every day. The thing is that in most cases, they're eating foliage that doesn't, and it doesn't outright kill the plants, but your goal is to minimize damage. So if you can get out there every day, especially in the afternoon, and pick them off, then you're reducing some of the feeding. There are sprays, of course, that you can use, including organic insecticides that will knock down the adults when they're there, but they don't really keep the next batch from flying in, and they're going to be flying in from all over the place. But one thing to consider, too, is on any of your plants that don't require pollination, that don't require bees to be there, try putting some netting over them. So floating row covers are great for vegetable garden things, even raspberries, when you don't need the pollination going on. So things like lettuce and beets and spinach, even, you know, tomatoes self-pollinate. So
onions.
And beans self-pollinate. You don't need bees visiting them. The only thing you really need bees visiting would be your vine crops. Peppers, I think, are going to really kind of be better off if the insects are coming in there. But if you put a floating row cover on them before these things emerge, the adult Japanese beetles tend to come from above and land down. And they're not going to, like, crawl up underneath any little opening in a floating row cover looking for something to eat. And that will keep them off. So it's a physical barrier. And really with insects, I think the more we can try to come up with physical barriers to keep them from accessing the plants, the better off we are. So that would be my suggestion. Anything you don't need pollination on, get a floating row cover on it soon before they hatch out. And then you're just not going to have a problem with them.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Diana Alfeth, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She's broadcasting with us from our Eau Claire studio. So great to have her along, and thank you for listening in. Callers online, so we'll go back to the phones and to Stephanie in Woodstock, Illinois. Stephanie, hello.
Well, hello.
What can we do for you today?
Well, us folks in the state line area, I'm near Walworth County, if you want to reference.
Yep.
Sometimes are told we're in climate zone 5, but it really feels more like we're in climate zone 4 because we're that far away from the Chicago and the lake effect. My ginkgo biloba tree it got damaged by these 30 below polar vortex. I don't even know what a ginkgo biloba climate zone is supposed to be. I don't know what it prefers. It looks like it's trying to rally back, but my gosh, the leaves are tiny, and every day I go out and they look a little tiny bit bigger, and the leaves at the tips of the tree are fine, and the very, very top seem to be almost normal size. They seem to be coming along. Is the damage permanent?
What do you think, Diana? Diana, are you there?
I can hear you now, but I can't hear the caller or anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. She's calling from Woodstock, Illinois. Her ginkgo tree was in trouble. The leaves are coming in, but they're very small, and she's wondering if the tree might recover. She was wondering about the zone for a ginkgo tree.
I can hear Larry, but not the rest of things. So can you hear me okay, Larry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. If the leaves are coming in small, that again is a good chance that there's some winter injury going on there. And again, smaller leaves coming out is a symptom of some blockage between the roots and the top of the tree. So look for root or trunk damage. Anything that might have happened to in the root zone of the tree since last year. So if there was any construction nearby, if there was flooding, if there was anything that would have damaged the roots. And then being in Illinois, it's obviously been warmer down there. I would think that it should be fully leafed out by now, but there's not anything that you can do if it's not leafing out totally, but it's going to be some kind of a block between the roots and the top of the tree. Now, I'm not 100% sure about ginkgo if they get verticillium wilt. That's a fungal disease that can cause these symptoms as well. I kind of don't think it does, but that would be something we'd want to check into. But I'd look for damage to the trunk, damage to the roots, or else I'd be starting to chalk it up to winter injury again.
Yeah, and she did have the polar vortex business in Woodstock, Illinois as well. I know a ginkgo, the zones, it's pretty broad range, 4 to 9, I think, on a ginkgo tree. So she's in the right zone
for it.
So there you go, Stephanie. I hope that helps.
Well, I wish you could have heard my comments because the tips are fine. It's the other ones. Can you hear me?
Oh, we're still...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the tips are fine, but it's the leaves further back?
It's actually, what gives me hope is the fact that at the very, very top and at the very, very end tips, those leaves are normal size and they're doing well. And every day I go out and I look at it, those tiny little leaves are a tiny bit bigger. So it's trying to rally back.
Yeah, I would just be patient with it. It sounds like you've got the water and stuff getting to the tips of the branches. So who knows? It might be that when those leaves were coming out, we got another one of our cold spells or something. And so things are kind of doing fits and starts this year. So I think you're probably going to be okay. Just give it a few more weeks. And it might be that the leaves this year don't get fully quite as big as they otherwise would have, but it'll recover for next year.
All right. There you go, Stephanie. Thank you so much. Connie in Portage, we'll go to you now. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I planted and I babied these, and that's why I'm so upset. I have a row of bridal wreaths that's about 12 feet by 6 feet high, and everybody else's has bloomed out. Mine has not. It's all brown sticks, except for one end, which bloomed out of about, you know, maybe a foot. And I don't understand what happened.
Yeah. Do you have some little green stuff coming up at the base?
Yes.
Yeah. That's winter injury. And for whatever reason, yours had maybe more exposure to wind. They're in a little bit lower spot. They had who knows exactly why yours, and it might just be a variety that's a little touchier, but I have that too. And it's just that those, as you say, dead sticks there, all those branches, they were damaged by the cold. So what you can do is just give it a little bit more time to make sure that you see what's sprouting up, what's going to be green, and what's dead, and then go in there and prune out the dead stuff as low down as you can, and then you're going to have short little shrubs for a little while, but they'll recover pretty quickly because they have a good root system.
And Pat emailed from Bayfield with kind of this. She has a beautifully blooming old bridal wreath spirea, and this year the snow flattened sections and their shape is now bad. She can just cut that back, can't she?
Yep, and she can, you don't want to cut it all the way back. You want some leaves on there so that the plant can do its photosynthesis and stuff. But prune back some of them. If something is broken down, prune it back as probably all the way to the crown. But you can do some shaping on it, and then you'll probably do some more shaping on it next year, and then it'll get back to its glory.
And she could do that now?
Yeah, especially if anything is broken off and dead, that can go. And she can do some other light pruning now. And we always say never more than a third of the plant at a time. So she can prune up to a third of that away and to get it shaped out better and then let it put on its new growth, and that'll be fine.
There you go. Wendy in Waukesha, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some shrubs, and they have a 1/3-inch worm on them, and they are devouring the leaves, and it's kind of yellow with black stripes and little dots on it, and they're very tiny, 1/3 of an inch. That's how long they are. I don't know what they are or what to do.
Yeah. So our first step would be to figure out what kind of shrub it actually is, because that makes a big difference on identifying what the little caterpillar is. But if it's a little caterpillar, there's going to be some caterpillar killer insecticide things that you could put on there. If it's possible, one of the easiest ways to go out there is put on a rubber glove and just kind of like pick them off, throw them into a bucket of soapy water or so and get them off there so that they stop feeding. The thing is with most of these caterpillars is they'll eat the leaves, but they don't damage the buds. So even if they eat every leaf off, the latent buds will sprout up and re-leaf out. So it's not in most cases, it's not a thing where it's going to kill the shrub. But getting those little caterpillars off of there so that they stop eating would be a good idea. Like I said, if it's manageable to pick them off, they've hatched, they're not going to, that's the larval stage of something, whether it's a beetle or a butterfly or a moth or a sawfly. So they're not going, they've all hatched, so there's not going to be breeding amongst those little caterpillars where you'll get more caterpillars. So if you can just get them off of there, Mm-hmm. Okay. You'll be fine. So, again, you can use an insecticide that kills caterpillars. But it would be best if we specifically identified them. So if there's any chance that you can, like, take a picture of them along with leaves of the shrub so we can identify the shrub and email it to me or maybe post it on Larry's Facebook page or something, then we can get a specific diagnosis for it.
Yeah, you could just post on ideas at WPR.org. If you've got a photo, we certainly can take a quick look and probably tell you what's going on there. Thank you, Wendy. I appreciate the call. Rick, I should say, in Bell Center. It's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi. About 2 days ago, I had a nice Miss Kim lilac bush in a two-gallon container, probably about 2 feet high. And I live out in the country, 90 miles west of Madison, and I planted it on a gentle hillside about 50 feet from the house 2 days ago. This morning I came out there. It was out of the ground, lying below the hole, bare root. The hole was there, completely emptied. What does that?
You know, it could have been deer. They could have grabbed it and pulled it out because the soil would have been loose. That would be my first thought.
Yeah, that's a good thought.
It obviously is an animal that's big enough to do that. Now, a two-gallon pot's not super big, so it's not a big, heavy kind of a thing. But I can envision a deer grabbing it, wanting to nibble on it, and then just ripping, you know, because they don't have teeth on what the top or bottom, I always forget. But so they rip stuff off when they eat it. So they could have just pulled it out as they were trying to, like, bite off the leaves or the tip of it. Otherwise, it's amazing how strong skunks and raccoons can be to dig things up. But I'm going to vote for a deer.
I would agree. There you go, Rick. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Bob emailed that he has just picked up two pear trees, different cultivars. They are each in two-gallon plastic containers. They're about 6 feet tall, a little over an inch in diameter. The trunks, he has 5 acres of land just north of Beldenville. And he is wondering about advice on where to plant them, how far apart and such. He has a few old apple trees, some flat land, some on the south slope, and the soil is a clay loam.
Okay. Well, the thing with all fruit trees and apples and pears are somewhat, you know, closely related in some ways, but is air circulation, because the biggest problem we have are like scab disease, fungal diseases. So for that reason, I would suggest to plant them at least 20 feet apart so that you're sure that you're getting good air movement between the trees and that keeps the humidity down, and then that reduces pressures from fungal diseases. As far as pollination stuff goes, bees can fly, you know, plenty far. So if you wanted to plant them 50 feet apart or even more than that, that's just fine. A south slope is great. Good air movement. Make sure it's not at the bottom of that south slope so that you get a frost pocket down there. So on the, you know, partway up is a good thing. And otherwise, you know, these conditions sound like they would be just fine as far as the soil and that goes. So
sure. Go for it.
I see pear pie in his future.
There you go. Well, Lynn in Cedarburg emailed. She has a fieldstone wall with quackgrass growing nearby, very thick and deep, and she can't dig it up. What can she do to get rid of the grass without damaging the spruce trees that are growing 10 to 15 feet away from the wall? She heard sprinkling salt on the grass will kill the roots. I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, the problem is that quackgrass is like
you can't
atomic
dig it up.
And it's extremely difficult to kill. It's because they have these long, long rhizome root systems that go for I literally have jump roped with quackgrass roots in my life.
Oh.
Yeah. So, and I have seen them grow up through blacktop. So it is probably the hardest thing to get control of. And especially when you can't dig it out, when it's in a fieldstone wall like that, you can pull it off all you want, and it's just going to come back because pieces of root system will be left behind.
Yeah, this is actually growing nearby the fieldstone wall.
Okay. Salt is... So salt is toxic to plants when it gets too thick or in high enough concentration. And so if it was like in the wall itself, you know, between the rocks and nothing else would be growing there, the roots, obviously spruce tree roots aren't going to grow up into that. You could give it a try, but you'd have to put a lot of salt on to kill quackgrass.
Yeah.
And those roots, you know, I don't know that you could get the salt into all the areas where the roots have wound their way and that sort of thing. So salt will damage quackgrass, but it's going to damage other plants as well. So it all depends on what's in the area there. And I know, you know, sometimes we can smother quackgrass if it's in the right situation. So if you put like a couple sheets of cardboard over it or old carpet or something like that. But even with that, those roots are so far and so so dispersed out that to get it all, and you'd have to leave that on there pretty much all summer to kill it. So that is a challenge depending on the site. And again, if it's growing in, you know, into that wall at all, that's going to be a pretty hard thing to do. So about the only other option is to use an herbicide, and we're talking glyphosate or Roundup, and that is the thing with Roundup is, as far as the plants go, it does not work by getting into the soil and being taken up into the roots. It works by getting on the leaves of the plant that you want to kill and going systemically into the plant and killing the roots. So for that reason, if you put it on and you put it only on the leaves of the quackgrass and not on the needles of the spruce tree, it should not harm your spruce tree at all, even if there are spruce tree roots growing under that quackgrass, because, again, it doesn't work by getting into the soil. So that, you know, I know a lot of people don't want to use Roundup or an herbicide, but depending on what else is around it, when you're dealing with quackgrass, there aren't a lot of other good options. So spritzing that quackgrass, keeping it on the quackgrass leaves, it'll go down in those long, long roots and kill them off. And that may be the only realistic option of getting rid of it.
Let's take a call from Sarah in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Ben, I have a question regarding some dieback or kind of wilting and dying leaves on some amelanchers that I have. There's a whole row of them. There's probably five or six clusters along 15 feet on a small rock wall, like a foot and a half high. Then it kind of tapers down to grade. And then on grade, we have a small red oak that's maybe 6 inches DBH or so, and a couple of sedum plants on the ground. And last week, I had just sprayed the bed line with some Roundup. There was some weed gone on the grass, nothing that I have never done before. And then this week on Monday, I noticed everything looked just a little wilty, like it could have been a water problem. These seem to be the only plants affected, and they are all wilting now. By the end of the week here, they are, like, turning brown and crispy. My first thought was herbicide drift, but the leaves aren't cupping. They are just genuinely wilting like they're lack of water, which is certainly not the case, and I don't think they've been overwatered. The area does get a lot of salt from the roadway salt. Do you think any of that is a combination, or could there be some other bacterial infection or other pest attacking this?
So it's the amelanchiers or it's everything?
It's everything. Okay. So the amelanchiers are looking the worst. The sedum are even wilted too. The lower maybe quarter to third of the red oak are even looking a little, they're not terrible, but they look weirdly droopy.
So on the red oak, it's the, you said the lower leaves are doing it, not the upper ones.
Yeah, I don't notice it quite as much with the upper ones. It's okay. Mostly like that lower third or so.
Okay. So
I do have it pruned up fairly high, like you can walk under it. So
okay.
They are a ways up.
So I don't think it's any kind of a disease thing because most diseases are very species specific. So
right.
a bacterial or fungal disease that would affect the amelanchiers probably isn't going to affect an oak or a sedum. So I think it is absolutely herbicide drift. And the main reason that I would tell you that versus the salt damage is because salt damage dries things out and it prevents the plants from taking up water. And so you're most likely to see those symptoms at the top of the plant, not the bottom of the plant, because that's the farthest away from the roots. The fact that it's the lower part on the oak tree, that's the closest to the herbicide that was applied. I'm suspecting your weed killer, the 2,4-D weed killer stuff. And sometimes, even if you're spraying it on a calm day, it might, you know, that the next day or so we might get like humid conditions and it can volatilize and form a cloud that drifts up and affects that. And I've seen that on trees where it bounces into those lower branches, and that's why you see the symptoms mostly there. So I think it's a really, really good chance that you're dealing with an herbicide drift, whether the product was mixed wrong or sprayed on a breezy day or volatilized and formed a cloud is kind of hard to say. So the next question is, what's the prognosis for your plants? And I would think that the oak tree, especially because the top stuff is not as affected as much, is probably going to be able to withstand it. Once a sedum starts drooping, it worries me.
That's the end.
Uh-huh. And the amelanchiers, there's a chance that you might get some dieback, but that it'll shoot up from latent buds. It all depends on how heavy of a concentration it was exposed to, but there's nothing you can do about it at this point. So I would just give it some time and kind of see how things shake out, knowing that these plants might have major dieback or total dieback, depending on how bad it got. But I'm really strongly suspecting it's the herbicide stuff.
Agreed. Sarah, thank you for calling. Len in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Len.
Hello, and hello, Diane. My name is Len, Janesville. Questions, please. I have several plants. I have a sycamore, I have an imperials, a poplar, white oak, and these trees were growing really great. I had them in containers. I wasn't quite sure where I was going to place them, so I had them in a garage during the winter. It's an attached garage, and then when I got the trees out and they started warming up and most hopefully they're going to start leafing out. Only about one-third of the tree started leafing out, and the rest of the tree was dead. And I also, I had two sycamores, got them both at the same time. One I actually planted in the ground. It's doing just great. The other one I had in a pot, and it's a good-sized pot. Again, it just about one-third of it's starting to grow out, and two-thirds from the towards the top, it's just branches. Nothing's happening.
Not good.
So you had them in a garage over winter?
Pardon me?
Do I understand it right that you had them in a garage over winter?
Yes.
And is the
I had all these in the garage, and actually I had one or two. Everyone I had was in the garage. It was in the garage. The garage was not heated, but it's an attached garage. It didn't get nearly as cold as the outside. But I was just curious, what would cause that where only just a third of the plant of the tree is starting to leaf out,
yeah,
and the rest of it looks like it's wintertime?
Yeah, I kind of, I'm going to suspect, and it's the top part of the tree that's not leafing out, you said, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I'm going to suspect that it got drought stressed at some point, that there wasn't enough moisture in that container to keep it alive. Because those, again, are the symptoms of drought stress, where not enough water got to those top branches and those top buds. So it could very well be that that plant just got too dried out in that container. When you overwinter them in a in a garage like that, it's really iffy for moisture and temperature, because you want them dormant. So you want them to be, you know, cold. But then the light conditions that are coming in a garage are not like normal, and the moisture conditions are not normal, and the cold conditions are not normal. And so it's a bunch of that. One other thing that happens in garages is there's, a growth hormone that plants make, that affects them, but it's also, formed by combustion engines, and that's ethylene gas. And ethylene gas can, abort flower buds. It can over-ripen things. It can keep tulips and daffodils from blossoming. And I'm not exactly sure how much it would affect leafing out. And I would expect that the whole tree would be affected, not just the top part. But there's always a chance that there was some connection there, or some added stress or something. But my first instinct is going to be that there just wasn't enough water in that pot to support it and keep it well hydrated through the winter.
And one other thing, too, in an unheated garage, it's probably best to put the pot on top of a board or something, and rather mm-hmm. than have it right down to the cement where the temperatures can fluctuate.
Yep. That's a good point, Larry, because it could have been that the roots got a little colder than they needed or wanted to be, and so that there was a few root damage issues as well, and that affected the plant's ability to take up water. So the good news is there's still some life in there, and you can let it grow for a little while, and then later on this year prune away the dead stuff and try to create, you know, choose something that's going to be the new leader and get it training up, and the tree should, you know, yeah, recover. Being that it's small and young yet, there's sure a lot of potential there yet.
Yeah. Good luck, Len. Thank you. We are talking today with Diana Alfuth. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Diana Alfuth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Our phone lines are filled, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Brian in Fond du Lac. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about apple trees.
Okay.
When my apples are about ready to pick, I've seen like railroad tracks just underneath the skin and the size of maybe like a pin. I guess my question is, some kind of insect is probably laying eggs on it. But my question is, what's the key time when they're doing that, when the apples like the size of a pea, like a nickel or a quarter, half dollar?
All right.
Yeah. I wanted to target my spraying a little bit.
Yep.
When are these insects attacking?
So there are three major insects that bother our apples. Plum curculio, and that one is laying eggs on them right now. They make a little half moon shaped slice in the skin and put their eggs underneath. There's codling moth, and then there's apple maggot. And the one you're talking about is probably apple maggot. And they are out for a long period of time during the summer. So really what you can do is you can hang some red sticky traps in your trees, and those are used not to catch them all and protect your apples, but to monitor when the insects are out there. And it varies depending on weather, and some years we have them worse than others, but you can put those traps out to monitor throughout the summer. What you need to do is to send me an email or go to the Learning Store site and get the publication called Apple Pest Management for Homeowners. It's one of our extension publications that is just invaluable. I give that thing out about 100 times a year.
It's really good.
It's just the best thing, because it will explain each of these insects and give you a better idea of when they might likely be out there. But then it also has a chart on there that talks about a spray schedule and what to spray when and for what. And people just stick that up on their refrigerator for the summer. And that's really what you need to get all the details that'll help you out.
So go to learningstore.uwex.edu, learningstore.uwex.edu, and you can find it there.
Yep. Just put in the search box some apples or apple pest management. And there are a couple different publications, but there's this one. I think it's, I don't know, 8 pages long or something like that. But on the last page is this wonderful chart to put on your refrigerator to remind you.
All right. There you go, Brian. Thank you so much. Jan in Viroqua, your turn.
Yeah, I also have an apple question. I have a very young apple tree. Its trunk is about an inch in diameter. And I'm wondering whether I planted it too close to the water line that comes in from the street, which I believe is one of those modern plastic affairs, because it was just laid about, the main was just laid about 4 years ago.
Okay.
And if I do have to move it, so I'm wondering how far away I should have my trees. And then if I have to move it, when's the best time to do that?
Okay. Well, the water main's not going to hurt the tree, and the tree's not going to hurt the water line either. So the only concern is that if in the future that water line needs to be repaired or replaced or something like that, then damage would be done to the tree when they dig it up. But if it was all put in not too long ago, that may be way, way, way down the line. So there's not a drastic need to move that tree, but if you decide you want to move it, the best time to move it would be when it's dormant. So that would be this fall, like September, after the leaves have started to change color and fall off, or else in the springtime before it leaves out. So, you know,
if this is me, I'd leave it there if I was just worried about the line, for sure.
I would too.
Yeah.
I would too.
Yeah.
Yep.
There you go. Jan, thank you. Rona in Cameron, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hello, Diane. I'm so excited to get a hold of you today. One of the things they said you might talk about was moss in the lawn, and I'm growing lovely.
Are you?
Yeah, that I don't want to be growing, but I think I know the answer, but I want your opinion. We live in a very forested area. Of course, the trees are getting taller. It's shadier. And this is the east side of our house, but it's encroaching on the little bit of lawn that I actually do have. So I need your help there. I also just thought of a second thing I was wondering about with all this winter damage. I have a willow that has, I can't remember, it's one of the shrub varieties, that has leaves on the bottom, it's naked, and then it has leaves on the top. And I'm very curious to know what could have caused that. If the vascular system isn't damaged, then what makes that happen?
Yeah, the willows, there's maybe the Arctic blue leaf willow shrub, and those things are, they don't follow any of the rules. They do weird things. And, you know, it's kind of hard to say. When there are leaves at the tip, that means the buds there were okay and they leafed out. Why the ones in the middle went bad, it you know, it could have been snow depth. It could have been wind currents. It's just really, really hard to say on that. So, but the good thing with those is you could cut that shrub all the way down to the ground and it'll be the same size by the end of the summer.
Yeah.
those willow shrubs are so wild. But
The moss on the lawn.
Moss on the lawn thing. That is a challenge. And I've been getting a lot of calls about it because we've had a lot of rain. Actually, for 3 years now, we've had very wet years. So moss likes moisture and it has a shallow root system. And grass doesn't like a lot, you know, over excess moisture, and it has a deeper root system. So when the soil is really wet, the grass roots don't go down as far, and they can't compete. So it sounds like your biggest problem is shade, and the shade is keeping it moist. It's also because grass is a full sun plant. It's not as robust as it otherwise would be. So you're getting some bare spots of some open spots of soil between the little grass plants, and the moss is happy to move in there. So the problem is that you can kill the moss. You can dig it out of there. You can get moss killers and kill it. But if those conditions are right, it's just going to come right back in. So if we're getting moss in the middle of a full sunny lawn, then what we're looking at is improving drainage through aeration, improving the health of the grass through proper fertility and a higher mowing height when setting your mower up higher, and that helps the grass to outcompete the moss. But if you've got a shadier situation and not full sun, you will forever be fighting that battle. So what you really have to look at is that a place where you really need lawn grass? Or can you put that into a nice, pretty mulched bed with hostas and pathways and things like that? Or is moss an okay ground cover? there's not really a good answer for that. You can't make grass grow in a moist, shady area.
No, you can't. But you certainly can make moss do it.
Yes, and there are all kinds of different shapes and sizes of moss, and people grow moss gardens, and that might be the thing to do. Order in some really cool mosses. And
there you go.
Yeah.
Diana Alfuth, our guest. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Great to have her with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. My guest today, Diana Alfuth, back with us. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County, and she also teaches landscape design at the UW River Falls. So it's great to have her with us. Certainly looking forward to your gardening questions. Reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we have Rick and Colfax with a question. Rick, hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, so about 17, 18 years ago, I planted 20, 24 or so apple and a couple of pear trees. And they were 3 years old. When they were 3 years old, we had a pretty good windstorm, and one of the pear trees went down. And, of course, that was it for that pear tree. However, the rootstock was still there, and it started putting out some shoots. And, oh, it's off away from the house. I don't really mind, so I just let those shoots grow. And after all these years, it turned into this big, beautiful old planty looking tree. It's really quite nice, but to my surprise this year, it got a whole bunch of blossoms on it, which I have never seen before. And of course the bees were on it and all, and I'm wondering if it's a possibility that it may produce some pears.
Yes, there is a possibility. And back then, I don't know what the best, you know, or the most common rootstock was that they were using for them. But if there are blossoms and there's pollen, in most cases, you're going to get a fruit of some kind. Now, what it'll be, you will wait and see. There's always a chance, you know, sometimes there's hybridization where the flowers are sterile and there's not really pollen and they don't get any fruit. But there's a very good chance that you get some kind of fruit on there. I took the risk of planting peach trees a few years ago. And that, you know, I thought, oh, this isn't going to work, but I'll give it a try. And of course, it didn't work. I actually got peaches the first year. I got a couple of little peaches and they were really, really, really good. But then the tree, as most of them do, because of winter stress, even though they're supposedly winter hardy, the winter stress stresses them enough that these bacterial canker diseases get in, and that's what killed the pear trees. And so that was all normal. But the rootstock came up. But the rootstock on peach trees is plum. And so now I have the same kind of thing, this stuff, and they actually get plums on every year. So, but they are the nastiest plum trees with big thorns on them, and they need to go. But there is, if you've got blossoms, you have a very good chance of getting some kind of fruit.
But it won't be the fruit that was that you were getting from the previous.
Right. Unless those shoots came up from above the graft.
And, well, yeah. That's possible.
But if they came up from the rootstock, then all bets are off. It could be anything. But who knows?
It's going to be a lot of fun, Rick, to see what you get. You're going to have to let me know.
I will.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Laura in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love lilacs, and I have just one sad little lilac bush in my yard. It's about 10 feet tall, about 8 years old. It's a purple bush. And this year it did not bloom. It's fully leafed out, but it did not bloom. At least I didn't think so. I was in the backyard the other day and saw one purple bloom and one white bloom at the very top. So that's all the flowering I got this year. I kind of assumed it was because of the winter stress, but I wonder if it's going to come back next year and bloom again.
Okay, well, there are a couple of things that cause lilacs to stop blooming. Have trees around the area grown up such that the shrub is kind of getting a lot more shade?
No.
Okay, because that's one of the things. The other thing is that lilacs can get, how can we put this, overly mature.
Yeah.
So in order to keep good blooming going, it's best if you do a little bit of pruning every year where you prune some of the branches or stems all the way down to the ground, and that causes the roots to send up new shoots. And things flower on younger wood, so I don't want to give any analogies to humans here, but...
get rid of the biggest third or so of the branches, eh?
Right. So if you've got a 10-foot tall shrub going on, that trunk diameter is probably pretty thick now. So doing a rejuvenation pruning where probably the best time to prune lilacs is usually right after the blooming is done. So it's about this time of year. If you prune, let's say you have six stems coming up from the bottom. If you take count however many stems you have coming up from the bottom, divide it by three and prune away the three biggest, fattest ones all the way to the ground. That'll cause some new shoots. And then if you do that for the next 3 years, your shrub will basically be no older than 3 years then. And it's that wood that's going to produce the flower buds. Now, there's always a chance that you did have some winter injury that damaged some of those buds. But if you've got 10-foot tall stuff, I'm starting to think that that's getting a little old.
Yeah, for sure.
And then won't want to flower, going into the future. So some rejuvenation pruning will definitely help.
There you go, Laura. And you could do that probably any time, but maybe right after the few that flower are done.
Right. And normally normally we say to prune things when they're dormant, so late March or whatever. But with lilacs, we are then pruning away the flowers for the year because the flower buds are formed in the late summer the year before. So we don't want to sacrifice those flowers. So then we say we'll prune it right after it's done pruning or done blooming. And that up here, the lilacs are still in bloom, but
yeah.
In the south, I think they're kind of
they're starting peak. To wane.
Yeah. So in a couple of weeks here would be a good time to go ahead and prune that.
Thanks, Laura. Jim in Lone Rock, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I called about this time last year, maybe a week earlier, and said that I had Japanese beetles on my grapevines and I was ready to pull them up. Well, the winter killed them back pretty well, but I have a peonies bush right beside the grapevines, and they're the first thing that attract Japanese beetles. I went out and looked. I have some on there now.
Oh, my. That's the
so
first
they
report.
They come in late May, and I keep hearing they come in middle of June or late June. They're here at the end of May, especially if it hits 75 degrees. Last year, I put 7 powder on them and on the grapevines, on the grapes. And I still got 30 quarts, so I'm kind of mellowed out about that. The winter killed them. My thought is that you got to put the powder right on the grapes. The directions say put it on the leaves and on the stems. Well, you got 120 days of rain to look forward to, so they're going to get washed off and... Yeah. It worked. I have a question about Japanese beetles.
Okay.
Are they what people used to call potato bugs?
No, they're not. Now, they do look a little similar in size and the fact that they're kind of a round oval and they've got long legs, but they are absolutely very different than the Colorado potato bugs. And if you're getting them this early, I would really love to see a picture of them to make sure that it's truly the Japanese beetle or if it's a rose chafer or something else, because I have not heard any reports of Japanese beetle being out yet. And if you consistently get them earlier than everybody else...
I think they're rose chafers.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about. Is your soil sandy where you are?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So rose chafers are in the sandy areas, and they look kind of like Japanese beetles, maybe a little less oval shape, but they come out a little earlier. They do the same kind of thing where they, you know, eat the leaves and that sort of deal. So I would love to have you, where did you say you live?
Lone Rock.
Okay. I would love to see you take a sample into your county extension office and have them ID it for sure to make sure that we're talking about Japanese beetles or some other related critter.
You might just take go online too and type in rose chafer and take a look at the photos that you're going to see as well. As I bet they're rose chafers for sure.
Yeah, that's my suspicion as well.
So there you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Margaret in Fort Atkinson, we move to you next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I planted some asters 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and I plopped them in this area that the owners prior to us had put plastic, you know, and, you know, 6 inches of rock, and they actually are doing really well, and they're bushy, but last fall they did not blossom. So I don't know if they're too crowded or on the internet I read that maybe they have too much nitrogen. I was wondering what you would suggest.
Mm-hmm. So are these like purple dome asters or the...
They're the miniature, not miniature, but like a foot tall or higher.
Yeah.
And they're very bushy. I mean, they're huge.
And they're in full sun?
Yes, and they didn't blossom. Well,
okay.
You know, I got maybe 3 or 4 flowers on each one.
Okay. So it could be that if there's too much nitrogen, plants will put out a lot of foliage and not put out the blossoms. It could have been, you know, any other kind of insult that happened at the time when they were trying to form the flower buds. So what I would do is to not fertilize them this year. And that way the nitrogen levels won't be an issue. And just see if you have a better year on them. If there's a lot of bushy foliage there and that sort of thing, and they're in full sun, they should blossom. So if they don't blossom for 1 year, sometimes we can just say, well, there was some weather insult or something that happened. But give them another year, and then we can see if this is something chronic. And then look for other things. But there's no other reason that they shouldn't blossom.
No.
So see what happens this year.
Yeah. Michelle in Waukesha, hello to you.
There. I have a similar problem with someone who called before about little caterpillars on their tree, and mine is a viburnum. It's blooming now. It's got the leaves are sort of maple-resembling variety, and then the flower is flattish with the larger flowers are around the perimeter, smaller in the center. It's just a gorgeous tree. But this year it's got a million of these little caterpillars, and I wonder if that's viburnum beetle.
Yeah, but viburnum leaf beetle, they are out right now, and so they skeletonize where they leave the veins there, but they eat the tissue between. Is that what happens?
And my husband wants to spray it, but you can't spray underneath every little leaf. What's a good pesticide? I don't want to lose this tree. It's just gorgeous. In fact, there's two of them, and they're both affected.
Yeah, and, you know, again, chances are it's not going to kill the shrub because it's going to eat that leaf tissue, but more leaves will sprout out. And this is the viburnum leaf beetle is something that's more in the south. We don't really have it up here, so it's not something we've been dealing with a whole lot here. But there are pesticide options for it. And like 7, which is one of our most common pesticides, carbaryl is the active ingredient. There's also permethrins. And you can... you don't have to contact every single little caterpillar, but you can treat with that. And again, it would be a matter of going to the store, finding an insecticide. Again, 7 will work. That's very commonly available, and just follow the label instructions. It's one of those things that is your viburnum in bloom right now or not?
It is.
Yes. So that's one of the concerns is protecting honeybees and other pollinators because you can affect them. So if you decide to treat it, do it like late in the evening. The caterpillars will be there, but the pollinators will not be active. So that can help to protect the pollinators. And one shot of this stuff is probably going to get rid of most of those caterpillars. And as I said before, these all hatched out from the eggs that were laid there. I think they were laid in the fall. So they overwintered on the shrub as eggs. And now the caterpillars have hatched out. So these caterpillars aren't going to breed with each other to make more caterpillars because this is the larval stage. So if you get rid of 80% of these caterpillars, the damage to your shrub is going to be minimized so you don't need to worry about every single one of them.
There you go. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Diane in Madison emailed that she'd like a recommendation for a small tree, 20 to 30 feet, along her back fence to block the view of her neighbor's house. Fairly sunny spot with good moisture and drainage. She was thinking of redbud because she likes the horizontal branching, but she's heard that redbuds don't do well in a sunny location. What do you recommend for that?
I'm wondering if she's thinking dogwood because redbuds do like sun, and they don't really have the horizontal branching, but pagoda dogwood does. And pagoda dogwood doesn't like hot or dry conditions, and it'll be susceptible to golden canker, which is a disease that it gets. So if by chance it gets afternoon shade, it would probably do fine with that if she's got plenty of moisture. And redbud is probably not one I'm going to recommend just because it's slow growing and if she wants to get a screen up there. So, and pagoda dogwood is a little bit faster growing and might be a good option. And it does have that great horizontal branching. Again, as long as it's not hot, dry,
should be
afternoon
okay.
stuff. Otherwise, you know, start looking at things like some of the taller crab apples because they'll form a nice thick canopy that creates a good screen. You could look at, I'm drawing my blank here. What am I trying to think of? Things like ironwood are smaller trees. For full sun,
Yeah. Well, I think you've given a couple of good ones, so
There's even like Japanese tree lilac could be an option.
Now that's a nice one.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of those that are going to have a nice thick canopy,
yeah,
so that you're getting that screening in summer, and about that height.
Drawing a blank from here. Anyway, there's
list.
Some ideas there for you. Thanks so much for that question. We have John in Port Wing emailed to say, as a forsythia, totally overgrown by a green spruce, he took the spruce out in hopes of reviving the forsythia and had no luck. It's a mess growing stem in a helter-skelter fashion. Can he cut this back to the ground in the fall to improve its shape and general health?
Probably, but my official answer is going to be to do what we talked about earlier with the third. So go in there and whack down. And it's a job to get in there, but whack down maybe like a third of the biggest, fattest branches, and then do it again next year and try to do the shaping and the rejuvenation over a couple of years. Now, with forsythia, quite honestly, if you whack the whole thing down, it probably would get shoots from the base, but it is a little more risky to cut the whole thing down and cut away all of the leaves that can, you know, feed the tree and stuff, so, or the plant. So it'd be better if you did it in stages, but just make sure that you cut things down all the way to the ground. That's going to encourage the new shoots from the base, and that will probably be the safer way to get it in check.
Dave in Bark River, Michigan emailed to ask if it's okay to put mulch around the base of his pear tree.
Absolutely, and highly, highly encouraged. Put it out for a good couple feet diameter so that you're getting the grass and the lawnmower away from the trunk of the tree. But when you put the mulch on, put it down about 5 inches thick, because that's what's going to smother out the competition, the grass and the weeds. But make think donut. So make sure that you don't put it right up against the trunk of the tree, but pull it away and start the mulch about an inch away from the trunk, so that it's like a donut or an inner tube that's around that trunk, not a volcano up against the trunk.
And Peter from Baldwin, he planted a Japanese maple zone 5 bush. Wonders how he can winterize this small bush. The zone 5 might be an issue.
Yeah, that's really going to be a challenge up here. It, as far as winterizing, you know, with roses, we'll do rose cones and protection and stuff. But a Japanese maple is usually more of a tree form, so it's taller and it's going to be more difficult to do that. So I would plant it in an area where it's not as likely to get cold winter winds. That might help it.
That's about
a lot. Yeah. Otherwise, what people do up here for something like that, if you really want a Japanese maple, is to plant it in a large container and then bring it into that unheated garage or unheated shed,
yep,
or something that's going to be not quite as cold as outside over the winter. And people put these huge pots on wheels and wheel them in and out with the seasons. And
there you
otherwise,
go.
It's just going to be hard.
Diana, thank you so much for being with us. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. It's always fun.
Diana Alfeth is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Great to have her with us. Monday, we'll talk about the breakup of iTunes and answer your tech questions. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Stay with us, though. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.